This is Radio Influence. Podcasting redefined.
Why, Crusher, it's good to see you.
Performance with the Crusher, Jeff Crushell. Get in on the talent grid and text Crush at 101260 with your questions, comments, or smart-ass remarks.
And welcome to Crush Performance, everybody. Jeff Crushell here, the con man behind the glass, keeping us on track. And we're your weekly source for performance information. If you want to get in touch with us, go to our website, crushperformance.com. On Twitter, follow us at Jeff Crush. And on Facebook, go to our page, Crush Performance. So, this is our final episode in our special investigative report, Sport Under Fire. Over the last few weeks, we spoke with some of the world's leading authorities on doping, match fixing, gambling, money laundering, organized crime, and human trafficking, all related to sport. This all started with two of our top storylines from 2017, the FBI investigation into fraud and corruption in college basketball and the Russian state-run doping program. It really opened our eyes to some of the serious things that are going on in the dark side of sport. So we wanted to look a little deeper to find out exactly what's going on. And not only that, how is this happening in this day and age? So as we started digging, the bottom literally fell out and we haven't hit the bottom yet. But we were turned on to a bunch of topics we never expected to look into, but we couldn't ignore. Money laundering, gambling, match fixing, doping, of course, organized crime and their role and control in world sport, and even human trafficking, all issues that we had to look into and we couldn't ignore. So over the last few weeks, we've spoken with some of the world's top minds in these particular areas to find out what's going on so we can start steering the boat in the right direction and, of course, to just raise awareness. Well, today is no exception. We don't normally think of human rights when we think of sport, but I'm telling you right now, we have to, because some of the things we uncovered when it comes to international sport and some of the major sporting events that we all love to watch were truly alarming. So to wrap up our series today, we will talk with Minky Warden, the Director of Global Initiatives for the Human Rights Watch. And I wanted to wrap up the series looking at organized crime. So we went to a conversation we've had with former mafia boss Michael Franzese, one of the most successful mafia bosses of all time, second maybe only to Al Capone. At one point, Michael was earning between $5 to $9 million a week in his operations in New York City. And it's said that most wise guys quit the mob in only one of two ways: witness relocation or in a body bag. Michael's avoided both, and he now uses his life experiences for the benefit of corporate executives, professional and student athletes, at-risk youth, and pretty much anybody seeking the inspiration to beat the odds and better themselves. Michael will talk to us today about how organized crime works, how they ran their operations in New York, why they infiltrated sport, how they did it, and what they hope to gain from it. That's all coming up on today's jam-packed episode of our investigative report, Sport Under Fire. Stick around, everybody.
This is Crush Performance. If you have questions, comments, or smart remarks, write to us at crushperformance.com.
And welcome back to Crush Performance, everybody. Jeff Crushell here, the con man behind the glass, and we're your weekly source for performance information. Today, our final episode in our special investigative report, Sport Under Fire, looking at corruption and crime and all the major issues we're seeing inside of the world of sport. And when we think of sport globally, you don't normally link it to human rights issues. But we had better start. And joining us right now to give us an overview and some background information as to why this is such an important issue in the world of sport is Minky Warden, the Director of Global Initiatives for the Human Rights Watch. Minky, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Minky, you know, we're doing a pretty extensive series here on corruption in sport, just trying to paint a picture and let everybody know what's going on behind the scenes. So hopefully we can get an idea on what's going on and what we can do to move forward. But in our investigations, you know, we found and uncovered a lot of disturbing facts and things that are going on behind the scenes. And when it comes to sport, we don't really think about human rights as being a major issue, but this is certainly something we need to talk about, isn't it?
It is. And I think the biggest area of concern is the global trend that Human Rights Watch has identified. And that is that the world's worst human rights abusers want to host the world's biggest sports events. And, you know, we all love to play sports. We love to cheer our teams. We want to see, you know, the human achievement played out on the sports field. But at the same time, I think we need to recognize that repressive governments have seized on the ability to host these big name sports events as a way almost to sports wash their reputation. And I'll give you some examples of that. The Beijing Olympics in 2008, the Sochi Olympics in 2014, the World Cup in Russia that's coming up this June in 2018, and the World Cup in Qatar, which is, you know, a tiny Gulf state, one of the richest in the world, that's building as many as a dozen stadium facilities in extreme heat at a cost of an estimated $200 billion. So we're both seeing the scale of these events balloon, but also the human cost of hosting these mega sporting events that we all enjoy watching.
Minky, I like that term, sport wash their reputation. That's a really interesting perspective and a very interesting way to look at it, because it's almost like a deflection almost, isn't it, Minky?
It is. I'll just give you the example of China. The country actually sought the Olympics in 2008 after the Tiananmen Square massacre. They wanted the world to forget that had happened. You know, with the current leadership in China, Xi Jinping, the leader, is has the worst crackdown in the post-Tiananmen period going forward, and yet the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, has rewarded them with the right to host the Winter Olympics. And I think it's no accident that a state that cracks down on journalists and environmentalists and others wants to host these big events. It's a way to build nationalism and international legitimacy while getting to launder your reputation. You have world leaders standing next to you on the dais. You hand out medals. And that should concern everyone who cares about sport.
Yeah, most certainly. And that's one of the reasons we're so happy to have this conversation with you. We're talking with Minky Warden, the Director of Global Initiatives for the Human Rights Watch. Well, Minky, let's talk about some of the atrocities that happen behind the scenes, because we know the sporting events and all the fever and patriotism that goes along with actually hosting. On the backside of it, there's a dark side as well. You know, you did a lot of work on Beijing as an example and some of the atrocities that went on there. Even before the games, a lot of people were removed from their homes with little or no notice. And that's just a small example of some of the things going on behind the scenes for these mega sporting events.
Sure. I mean, just, you know, I think we just have to put ourselves in the position of some of the ordinary citizens whose lives are upended and made miserable by these mega events. And the example of Beijing is a great one. As many as 10,000 people were bulldozed from their homes to make way for the games. In some cases, there was corruption. People were bulldozed out of their homes because a property tycoon wanted to put a shopping mall there, and they did it in the name of the Olympics. We don't know because there's no due process. There's no rule of law in China. Journalists who tried to report on this got arrested. And if you've ever been to Beijing, there's an old section of town that has buildings called hutongs. They've been in families in some cases for 900 years. A lot of those families fought very hard to keep those buildings that they lived in, but that were also had a historic tie to their families. They were bulldozed out with simply no recourse. That's an example of the types of abuses. In fact, we've identified the signature abuses that almost always happen around these mega events, and they're forced evictions without compensation. Just by the way, you can be evicted as long as you've had compensation. So the abuse is when you're just bulldozed out without fair compensation for your home or your livelihood. We saw that in Beijing and in Russia. We've seen it around a number of these events, including Turkmenistan for the Asian Indoor Martial Arts Games this September. Second abuse is migrant labor abuses. Those stadiums don't build themselves. As many as 6 workers died on the Bird's Nest Stadium for the Beijing Olympics alone. For the Sochi Olympics, we did a report called Race to the Bottom about how migrant workers worked in dangerous conditions, but were cheated of their wages. They'd work for a year, and then when the time came to pay them, they were beaten up and thrown out of the country. We worked with the IOC, in fact, to get 6,175 workers paid back $8 million in wages that they'd been cheated of. But they shouldn't have been cheated in the first place. It's just not consistent with the Olympic ideals. Other abuses that you always see is, if you have civil society or people who are working on the environment, working on human rights, they often go straight to prison with long jail terms if they say anything critical about the Olympics. There's one village in Russia that had no clean water for 6 years, and the water table was poisoned by Olympic construction. And whenever we complained about it, and the IOC would ask them to, they would truck in a barrel of clean water, and then the water would be gone, and they'd be back where they were before. And another final area is, of course, press freedom. All of the way these organizations, FIFA and the IOC and other sports bodies, make their money is actually the sale of media rights. So you'd think that they would be frontline defenders of press freedom. And yet they keep rewarding or awarding these games. The Olympics have been awarded for 2022, the Beijing Olympics for winter, been awarded to China, which has no press freedom, no internet freedom. And it's not clear to me how journalists are going to be able to work in those conditions. So I think the system is broken, but we're also, with having Russia hosting the World Cup next summer and Qatar hosting the World Cup in 2022, we also are able to use these just horrible examples of human rights abusing hosts as a way to get some systemic change.
We're talking with Minky Warden, the Director of Global Initiatives for the Human Rights Watch. Very, very important work, Minky. The things we're talking about here, I think, are incredibly important. And again, something that we don't typically associate with sport and these major events that are, sort of, I guess, built to create pride and patriotism in our countries and for our athletes that are competing. When we talk about Russia, for example, if we go back to Sochi, I mean, there was a $51 billion build there. And I think, when we look at the environment and the upset that we've seen sort of in backlash post-Olympics, it's been alarming and if not catastrophic in a lot of situations. But some of the projections going into Qatar's 2020 World Cup, I mean, what we're seeing already is alarming. But I kind of like your approach here that this is an opportunity maybe to set some standards and move forward in the right direction.
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. I think it's... there's no possibility that that FIFA is going to remove the World Cup. So we have no choice but to actually use the fact that they are hosting and that they are building. The latest estimate from the Qatari government is that they're spending $500 million a week building World Cup facilities in Qatar. Now, mind you, not a single one of those existed before. And they're building entire cities around these stadiums. So there's really no way to overestimate the scale of what's going on here. And it's being built entirely by migrant workers. If your listeners have interest in this, there's a wonderful documentary film that's just out. It's won a lot of awards called The Workers' Cup. The Qatari government decided to stage a PR effort and to let the workers building the stadiums actually play soccer or football, as they call it. And even what the government is prepared to show you tells you just how tough the lives of these workers are. Construction work is inherently dangerous. But there is no reason a single worker should die building a stadium. For the London, the London Olympics, no government is free of human rights abuses. But I'll tell you that the London Olympics, a major sporting event, were staged without a single worker death building all of those facilities. So it's just not necessary that hundreds or thousands of workers die to deliver a World Cup. And I think Human Rights Watch and others have pushed FIFA very hard to put in place a new human rights policy that requires worker protection. We put out a report this September about the heat risk. And if you've ever been to the Gulf, you'll know that the heat can climb to extreme conditions. Workers there in their 20s and 30s have been dying of what we can only call preventable death. They're dying of heat exhaustion, or they're carrying huge concrete slabs that fall on them. They're dying very, very bad, but also preventable death. And I think Qatar has actually, under pressure from the International Labor Organization, was bringing a forced labor complaint against them. And at the last minute, they've made a number of reforms. The kafala system, which is modern day slavery, operates across the Gulf, not only Qatar, but Saudi Arabia, the UAE. The system says that when you go to work for a company, you become essentially the property of the company. You can't leave without the permission of your employer. And if your employer is abusive, well, you can imagine how awful that will be. So our report that we put out in September said that the World Cup, that FIFA and Qatar have made some reforms. For example, when the heat reaches life-threatening levels, they will sound an alarm, and workers can come off the site. But that's just not good enough. So we've said also that these reforms have to extend beyond the stadium door. And if any of your listeners are planning to go to the World Cup in Qatar, planning to watch the World Cup in Qatar or Russia, you should know, for example, with Russia, 20 workers have died building World Cup facilities for the World Cup that will take place next June, in June of 2018 in Russia. I believe that fans don't want to sit in stadiums that workers died to build, that sponsors shouldn't want to underwrite a World Cup that costs workers' lives. So I hope we're reaching the moment in 2018 where we can get some concrete permanent reforms so that not a single worker has to die to deliver a World Cup or an Olympics.
Minky, one last question I'd like to run by you. You know, when we talk about the North Korean slave laborers in Russia, the idea of the human trafficking side, I mean, it's been said that human trafficking is the fastest growing criminal enterprise on the planet, netting somewhere around $150 billion per year. It's the third largest criminal enterprise overall. And it's very alarming to see that this migrant worker situation might be part of that world, as well as the trafficking of young child athletes to some of these sporting complexes. It just raises a whole other area of concern. And I think things we need to raise awareness about around the world of sport.
Well, thank you for raising that. The latest statistics are that as many as 60 million people are living in conditions of human bondage. And a large number, you know, I think what globalization has meant is that workers are prepared to do many things to support their families or to put their children through school. And they often don't recognize that they're being recruited into a situation of human bondage or human trafficking. And we certainly know it happens in the construction industry, bonded labor, forced labor, where your passport is confiscated and you have no way to escape, and then you're not paid. If you have, Human Rights Watch has documented a lot of problems with contracts, for example, in Russia. If you don't have a contract, then how are you going to guarantee that you are paid what you were promised? So workers are very vulnerable. Athletes are very vulnerable. I think the a lot of the sports is one of the industries that can bring great fame or fortune, but many workers, many athletes, have gotten themselves into a situation where they're unable to leave or change teams or get access the money that they've been promised. This actually happens quite a bit in the Gulf. So I think the human trafficking dimension around sports is one that's of great concern. It's very hard to research. Human Rights Watch hasn't done that research, but I think we know that traffickers prey on human hope and aspirations for a better life for family members. And some people even sometimes willingly enter a situation where they could be trafficked just to support their children. And I think that makes them among the worst people in the world. Because of the money that is involved in sports, both in the construction sector and for athletes and others, it means that this sector is open like every sector, every employment area to human trafficking. It may be right in front of us and we're unable to see it because it's secret. But I think the more you shine a spotlight on human rights abuses around sport, the more people participate, work for, take part in these events with an understanding that that really sports shouldn't be marred by these abuses. And I'd really appreciate it if any of your listeners are especially moved by this work. Reach out to FIFA, reach out to some of these bodies and tell them you care about human rights and you don't think abuses are consistent with the values of sport. But I'm really grateful to you for tackling this topic today. 2018 is going to be a year when we're either going to see a lot more abuses or we're going to see a lot of reforms. And Human Rights Watch is going to be pushing to make sure it's a lot of reforms. So we're grateful to you for helping ignite the discussion around the need for this.
It's our absolute pleasure to talk about this, Minky. Thank you so much for the conversation. Enlightening, alarming, and informative. And I think it gives us a good idea of what's going on behind the scenes in the world of sport when it comes to human rights. I have to thank you for this, Minky, and everybody over at the Human Rights Watch for all the good work you're doing to protect the integrity of sport. And, human rights in general. So thanks so much for that. Hey, we have to cut out for a quick break, everybody. When we come back, we continue our investigative report. We've been trying for weeks, and we've been going back and forth with former mafia boss Michael Franzese to talk about organized crime and their incentives and the reasons they're so interested in sport, which might seem obvious, but how they go about their business and why they do it is a very, very interesting discussion. We haven't been able to connect with Michael, unfortunately, so we're going to replay a very powerful discussion we had with Michael a couple of years ago, talking about how the mafia operates, organized crime, and how they infiltrate sport and what they hope to benefit from it. It's a great conversation. If you have not heard this before, it's worth a listen. And even if you have, it's probably worth hearing again. So, our conversation with former mafia boss Michael Franzese is coming up right after this on the Crush Special Investigative Report, Sport Under Fire. Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. If you're a serious athlete, a weekend warrior, parent, or coach, join us each week as we investigate the latest trends and research coming out of the sport performance world. We'll visit with top athletes, coaches, and sport scientists to keep you on the cutting edge and to find out what it truly takes to achieve human maximum performance. You can visit us online at crushperformance.com, and Crush Performance Radio with me, Jeff Kershaw, can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and at Radio Influence.
You're listening to Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. Get the Crush blogs, podcasts, and performance links at crushperformance.com. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back to Crush Performance. If you want to get in touch with us with any of your questions, comments, or smart remarks, do so. We love them all. Crushperformance.com is the website. You could follow us on Twitter at Jeff Crush. And on Facebook, go to our page. It's called Crush Performance. Today, the final episode in our three-part series looking at corruption and crime in sport, Sport Under Fire. The integrity of sport, we believe, is under fire, and we need to make some moves to protect it. And we know the only true way to solve a problem is to accurately define the problem. And that's what this whole series has been all about. Getting with the world's top minds and experts to dig down deep and find out what is really happening in sport so we can start moving forward in the right direction. And I wanted to wrap the series up with a conversation with former mafia boss Michael Franzese. Michael was one of the biggest money earners in organized crime since Al Capone. He now travels around the world using his experiences for the benefit of corporate executives, professional and student athletes, at-risk youth, and pretty much anybody who's seeking to beat the odds and make themselves better. We've been trying to connect with Michael for weeks now. It just hasn't worked out. So unfortunately, we'll have to continue to try to hook up with Michael to get that interview in the bank. And we'll play that as soon as we get it for sure. So in lieu of having Michael live, I'm going to go back to a conversation we had with Michael a couple of years ago, and it is all powerful. It gives us a good idea of how he got involved in organized crime, how it operates behind the scenes, and some of the reasons they're really focusing on sport and what they hope to gain from it. It's an incredibly interesting conversation. If you have not heard it before, it is worth a listen. There's no doubt about it. And even if you have heard this conversation before, it's definitely worth another listen. So, from the Crush Archives, here's our conversation with former mafia boss, one of the most successful money earners in the history of organized crime, Michael Franzese. Michael Franzese, welcome to the show.
How are you, Jeff? Good to be here.
Hey, very, very good. Now, a number of years ago, I met you when I was working with the Toronto Blue Jays, and you were consulting with the FBI and going from team to team, talking to the players about, you know, their situation and the tentacles of the underworld crime getting into the sports world. And I thought that was a very powerful, powerful presentation for all the players. But before we get there, maybe let's talk about your background, because it's absolutely fascinating. You know, you were named one of the biggest money earners in the mob since Al Capone. That's a great accolade if you're looking at it from a perspective. And you're 18th on the list of the 50 most wealthy and powerful mafia bosses. Now, Michael, this is quite the resume and accolade list here. Maybe you could tell us growing up how you got into the business and how you were able to earn $5 to $8 million per week. It seems unbelievable to us.
Sure, Jeff. You know, my dad was the underboss of the Colombo family, one of the five New York La Cosa Nostra families back in the 60s. And, you know, he was a very powerful figure in that life. He was always a major target of law enforcement, target of the media. So I grew up, you know, pretty well in that lifestyle, even though my dad didn't want me to be part of that life. He wanted me to go to school and get an education. And I was on that road until he got in some real trouble back in the 60s. He was indicted several times in the state of New York, went to trial a few times and was acquitted each time in the state. But then in 1966, he was indicted in federal court for masterminding a nationwide string of bank robberies. After a lengthy trial, he was convicted and sentenced to 50 years in prison. And in 1970, after he lost all his appeals, he was shipped off to Leavenworth Penitentiary to do his time. Now, I was a pre-med student at Hofstra University when I went in. And it was funny, I was kind of a jock myself. You know, I played two sports, and that's where my head was at the time. But I love my dad very, very much. He was a great father, and, you know, I almost idolized him as a kid. When he went away, I was devastated because he was 50 when he went in, and, you know, I figured at 50 on top of that, my dad would never come out of prison alive. So at that time, you know, I was a freshman in college, and Joe Colombo was the boss of my family. He was close to my dad. He kind of took me under his wing. I started to see a lot of my dad's friends, and they would fill my head, you know, Mike, you're going to school, your father's going to die in prison. If you don't help him out, he's never going to get out of there. And that really influenced me. I went to see Dad in Leavenworth Penitentiary, and I lost interest in school. And I said, Dad, if I don't help you out, you're going to die in here. And I got to make a change in my life. And he was upset, didn't want it for me. But we kind of argued about it in the visiting room. And I was pretty headstrong as a kid. He knew my mind was made up. And he said, son, if you're going to be on the street, then I want you on the street the right way. And in his mind, the right way was for me to become a member of his life. So he told me to go home, that he was going to send word downtown. He was going to propose me into membership for the family. And he did. And, you know, that's how it started for me. I was proposed. The boss at that time, Joe Colombo, he was shot and seriously wounded. A new boss that took over, who's now dead, Tom DiBella. And Tom sat with me and he said, Mike, you know, this is the message I got from your father. He said, you want to become a member of our life? I said, yes. And he said, well, from now on, 24/7, you're on call to serve this family. And if your mother is sick and dying and you're at her deathbed and we call you to service, you leave your mother and you come and serve us. From now on, we're number one in your life before anything and everything. When and if we feel you deserve this privilege, we'll let you know. And I was 22 years old. In kind of like a pledge period for the next year where I had to do anything and everything I was told to do to prove myself worthy. And, you know, I'll let your imagination go with that one. But all I can tell you is, you know, there's a lot of discipline in that life, a lot of authority, structure. And at times the life is very violent. And if you're part of that life, you're part of the violence. And, you know, you got to do what you got to do to prove yourself. And after about a year, I was called into a room again, and it was Halloween night, 1975, that myself and five other guys took an oath and became sworn, made members of the Colombo crime family. That's how it started for me.
Wow, we're talking with Michael Franzese, one of the top and most powerful mafia bosses, and on a list of the 18 or the 50 most wealthy and powerful, you're just five behind John Gotti himself as a member of the Colombo crime family. Well, let's talk about this. As a pre-med student, this is just a major shift. I can't imagine how this would happen as a pre-med student and hitting the street. You know, the imagination does run wild here, Michael. You know, the closest we're ever going to get to it in our lives is watching the movies on TV, you know, and you've been depicted in a couple of those movies. How accurate is that in terms of, you know, letting our imagination understand what you're talking about here?
Well, you know, in terms of the most accurate movies that are out there, I mean, The Godfather, Jeff, I mean, I love that movie. It was probably the greatest, you know, movie that was done in that genre, but it was fictional. And they were fictional characters. But you take a movie like Goodfella, where they did mention my name,
yes,
or Donnie Brasco. I knew both of those crews really well. And that's a pretty accurate portrayal of the life. They got it fairly right in both of those films. And they were based upon true stories, and they were pretty close to reality. So in watching those films, you get a pretty good sense of what the life was all about.
Well, Michael, when you're inside of the family now, I'm just very interested about this. You know, you've been accepted into the family. You're on call 24/7. Did you have freedom to reign, or were you following rules? How did you get to the point where you were leading and then, you know, setting up the systems to earn $5 to $8 million per week?
Well, you know, when you come into the life, I mean, obviously you know, you got to answer to your boss. So you come in as a soldier and you're appointed, you know, under a cop regime or captain. And you always have to, you know, report to that person and ultimately to the boss. But you're given free rein in the fact that if you're an earner, they want you to go out and earn money. I mean, that's what it's all about. And you bring money for yourself and for the family. Now, you know, the fallacy is that you come into that life and everybody becomes wealthy. Well, that's not the case. You know, the life is really separated. There's no middle class. You either are an earner or you're just a guy that, you know, is part of the life and becomes useful and does the work, so to speak. And in our family, the Colombo family, we had maybe 115 made guys at that time. It was really about 20 of us that were earning good money. The rest, you know, we kind of supported, and they got union jobs, and they just were loyal guys that hung around. So I was encouraged to go out and do what I could. And I had kind of a head for business. And, you know, I was fortunate, Jeff, in that I knew how to use that life to benefit me in business. And I was very aggressive. I worked 18 hours a day. I got into a lot of different things. I mean, I had two automobile dealerships that I owned. I was had interest in a couple of restaurants. I had a leasing company. And, you know, on the illegal side, I had a major bookmaking operation. I had 12 or 13 bookmakers working for me. I was very heavy into, you know, union and labor racketeering. I had a construction company that I used the unions to benefit me from. And my biggest, you know, earning that I ever made was through the gasoline business. And I fell upon something there with somebody, and, you know, the amount of money I was making out of that operation. And basically, we were just defrauding the government out of the tax on every gallon of gasoline. And it turned out to be an operation where I was grossing, you know, $60 to $70 million a month.
$60 to $70 million a month. We're talking to former mafia boss, Michael Franzese. Michael, that is an incredible story. Now, the tables turn. Getting out must have been an absolute scary episode in your life. I mean, it seems to me, just knowing, you know, the rumors and hearing you talk before, that's not just something you walk away from, simply shaking the dirt off your hands and riding off into the sunset.
No, you know, I mean, you know the story. I'm sure most people know that when you leave that life, they say you either leave in a coffin or you join the government and enter a witness protection program. And when once you're in for life. You know, what you know about the life, you can't erase. It's in your mind, your heart, and there's no way to just say, hey, I'm done. And, you know, I mean, it's hard to really summarize what happened, but I'll do my best. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been in the life a number of years. They didn't make me a captain. I was a cop of regime. I was appointed that in 1980 by my boss. And quite honestly, you know, they were grooming me to possibly take over the family. The boss had a son. He and I were very close. We came in at the same time, the same age, and our dads were grooming us to take over the family. And you know, but I got to, you know, I knew what the life was all about at that point, and I saw some things that were, you know, really kind of, I don't want to use the word scary, but kind of disappointing, because, you know, the life is supposed to be built on respect, and to a degree it is, but then to a large degree, there's a lot of politics and things go down that you would hope wouldn't go down in a life of allegedly of honor. So, but I would have never left. I mean, I was at the top of my game. I became a major target of law enforcement. I beat five cases. I beat Giuliani in a big racketeering case. You know, I had my own helicopter. I had a jet plane. I had the houses in three, you know, major states in the country. I'm bringing $8 to $9 million a week, my end, into the operation. So I had it going on. I mean, I was at the top of my game. And, you know, I had an interest in a production company. I was making movies out in L.A. A guy had got me involved, and I invested some money. And we were making movies for a couple of years. And I produced a movie, which was a breakdance movie, a lot of music and dance, back in 1985. And on the set of that movie, I met a young woman. She was a dancer in the film, who I fell very much in love with, is now my wife of 26 years. And she was actually my motivation for walking away from the life. And how I did it, Jeff, I got to tell you, there's no blueprint for walking away from that life. But, you know, I'm a guy that took certain risks in my life. I thought I knew the life well enough to where I could make a break, move out to California. I wasn't going to let anybody walk me into a room, you know, in one night, because the unfortunate part of that life, your best friend can walk you in a room when you're in trouble, you don't walk out again. And I said, well, that's not going to happen to me. And I did what I could to try to protect myself. But when it became public that I was walking away, all hell broke loose for me. And boss puts a contract. My dad disowns me. The feds are all over me to become a witness, because they said, you know, you're a dead man anyway. Words all over the street. And I had 7, 8, 9 years of a real struggle. You know, I took a plea on a major case to kind of make the break. I got a 10-year sentence. I did 8 on the 10. They locked me down for so much of the time because my life was in danger. And I just went through a lot of struggles to get out. But, you know, I changed my lifestyle. I used whatever knowledge and experience I had. And I can tell you at this point, I just about outlasted everybody. Everybody I knew in that life is either dead or in prison forever. You know, you mentioned that Fortune magazine article.
Yeah.
It was written in 87. It was 50 of us on there. 50 biggest and most powerful mob bosses in the country was the title. And they had a chart with the 50 of us on there. I was number 18 on the list in rank. I was 5 behind Gotti. They ranked me. And I was the youngest guy on the list. Well, the interesting thing is that today, 23 years later, out of that list of 50, 43 of them are dead. 3 of them that I know of are doing life in prison. And by some, you know, fortunate reason, I'm here to talk to you here today and do what I do now. So, and also the 5 guys that the night I got made, there were 6 of us. All 5 of them are dead, and not one of them died of natural causes. So to say that I've been fortunate and blessed and just happy to be where I'm being would be an understatement.
Wow. Michael Franzese, former member of New York's feared Colombo crime family, joins us. Well, you've taken a turn, 23 years, and wouldn't you know it, it took a lady to get it done. I mean, how many times have we heard this story? It happens in your world just like it happens in our world, it seems. But we're glad it happened, because meeting you with the Blue Jays and the presentation you gave to the players there really painted a different picture in terms of sports and how the criminal underworld has stretched its tentacles into the world of professional sports. Because let's face it, that's a big money racket as well. Michael, maybe you could share with us what you share with so many athletes out there in terms of being aware of what's going on around them.
Yeah, you know, my basic message, and I got to tell you, you know, I owe a lot to Major League Baseball and all the pro leagues, because they actually solicited me in prison to participate in a video that all the players saw at that time. And it was an anti-gambling video. They did a great job on it, in my opinion. They spent about $250,000 and talked about, you know, Pete Rose and Sleaster and all those guys. And I did my part when I agreed to do it. And they featured me kind of prominently. When I got out of jail, they asked me to take the message directly to the players. And that's how I got to meet you and do what I do now. And basically, I let them know, you know, players are targeted. Gambling is a major, major business for organized crime. And during my time, when I had these bookmakers working for me, I wasn't a bookmaker myself, but every bookmaker on the street that can you know, cover a decent bed is somehow associated with organized crime, especially in New York. I mean, you can't operate without being associated with one of us. We just wouldn't let you. And, you know, we had a lot of players gambling with our bookmakers, and we'd get them in trouble. You know, they'd get into debt for $20,000, $30,000. I remember so often, Jeff, I'd get a call from the bookmaker, you know, so-and-so is gambling with us. Mike, he's in debt for $20,000, $25,000. Should I cut him off? And I would say, why cut him off? You're writing down an entry on a piece of paper. Let him get in debt with you for $100,000, $150,000, $200,000, and then bring him to me, and then I'll show you how we'll make some real money. And, you know, we targeted a lot of these guys because, as you know, gambling is prevalent in the leagues, and especially what I'm seeing more today than ever is on the college level. So many of these student athletes, because there's so much access to gambling today, are getting themselves in trouble. We just had another, you know, article in the paper today about a student athlete from Auburn, you know, who's involved in a punch-shaving deal, at least the allegations of that. Not too long ago, a few months ago, University of San Diego. It happens all the time, and that's why I try to get myself out there and try to educate the players, because they don't realize that there's such big money in gambling on sports, both on the street and legitimately, and that gamblers will take advantage of that. And these guys don't realize that they're targets, and they got to be careful who they get involved with, and their gambling habits themselves, because not only can they get in trouble that way, but Jeff, I'll be honest with you, I've been around everything in my life. You spend 20 years on the street and you see drugs, you see alcohol, you see all of this kind of stuff that just destroys people's lives. But I will tell you, I've seen more lives destroyed over gambling than I have either drugs or alcohol. And it could be a very, very addictive vice, and people really got to be careful, and especially our athletes. They got to watch because they're targets.
There are no question. We're talking with Michael Franzese, former a mafia boss with the Colombo crime family of New York. Michael, you said something very interesting. I just want to, for our listeners' sake, maybe paint the picture, the dirty picture side here. When those guys actually were brought to you, what was your approach then? I mean, this is where things probably got really ugly.
Oh, yeah. Well, here's basically the pitch. And, you know, these were players that were known, you know, known and unknown. And, you know, they'd bring them to me and I'd say, hey, so-and-so, you know, you owe me a couple of bucks here. I didn't know if you knew, but the guy you've been gambling with has a partner and I'm him. And how are you going to pay me? And, you know, back then, as you know, guys weren't making, back in the 80s, they weren't making the kind of money they were making now. If they were in debt for 100, 150, that was a lot of money. And they tell me, well, you know, Mike, I don't really have it, and so on and so forth. And I say, well, you know what? You're a good guy. I like the way you play. I tell you what I'm going to do. You don't have to pay me all at once, but I'm going to charge you 5% a week on 100. So you give me $5,000 a week in cash until you can get that 100,000. So I'm going to give you a break. And he would go away, and, you know, he's saying to himself, he don't want to say it to me because he wants to get out of the room. $5,000 a week. Oh, my gosh, how am I going to do that? And he'll pay 2, 3, 4 weeks, and then he can't do it anymore, and we'll bring him back. And I'll tell him, listen, you know, you got to pay. You don't walk away from this debt. And if you don't want to pay me, you know, don't worry about it. You could leave here today and you don't have to come back. I'll find you when I'm ready and I'll take care of it my way. Or I'll give you another option. Here's the deal. You know, you're a football player. You're a basketball player. If he's a basketball player, we'll go easy because it's an easy sport. You know, any basketball player on the court has tremendous impact on a game. One player.
Right.
And
absolutely.
I tell him, listen, guys, you know, you don't have to win or lose. It's not about that. It's all about the spread. So if you're favored to win tomorrow night by 10 points, you make sure you don't cover. Win by 7, win by 6, win by 8. I don't care. You do that. You did that for me 3 or 4 times. We'll be even. I'll handle my end. You just do your end. And then you don't have to worry about nothing. We shake hands and we're friends. And if you don't want to do that, leave here today. And like I said, I'll deal with it in another way. But, you know, don't count on too much longevity in your sport. And that's it. You don't have to say too much more, Jeff.
You're right. And I get the message loud and clear. Trust me, I'm sitting here and I get it. Hey, you literally owned these guys. They had no choice. You were in total control. And Michael, I got to ask you right now before we let you go. Hey, this is still happening today.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Jeff, I got to tell you too, you know, some of the pro players that I talk with, they're not going to throw. I don't see them throwing a game. They make enough money, but the money, the losses that some of these guys have talked to me about and some of the things that they've done as a result of these losses, it's a shame. And I tell them, you know, you guys better have good, you know, a good retirement plan. You better make your money and sock some of it away, because if you continue these habits when you're out of the sport, you're going to have some problems. And on a college level, these young people, you know, I make the same offer every time, Jeff. When I leave a school, I tell them, listen, you got an issue with gambling or anything else, I'm your friend. I don't have to know your name. I don't work for the NCAA. I'm not part of enforcement. I don't have to report to anybody. I'm here to help. If you have an issue, email me. Email me from a bogus email address. I don't care. I just want to help. I got to tell you this, Jeff. I've done over 400 universities, mostly Division I, some Division II mixed in there. It has never failed me yet. By the time I get back to my hotel room, I have emails from students that I spoke to that in that session that have gambling issues.
Wow, Michael. An incredible story from a pre-med student to one of the most renowned mafia personalities. Now you're a man on a mission, talking to corporate executives, professional and student athletes. You go and work with at-risk youth and church audiences and basically speaking to anybody to share your knowledge with them to help keep them out of trouble and put them on the path. An incredible story.
Jeff, thank you. And you know, just for your audience to know, you know, I tell our young people, it's very possible to start out one way in life and end up 180 degrees to the other side. And that could be good or bad based upon the choices that you make in life. And I try to be an encouragement to let people know, you know, I came to where I am now fighting and screaming. I wasn't looking to be a good guy in many ways. I just wanted to escape a life and have some peace. And I got led to where I am now. And it's been extremely rewarding to be able to be out there and encourage people and hopefully give them some advice and based upon my experience as to how they can stay out of trouble, not get into trouble, turn their lives around, because it really can happen in this life. And we just got to surround ourselves with good people and try to do the best we possibly can. And we have a good shot of making things work out.
Michael, hey, appreciate your time today. Listen, what great, great conversation. We'll definitely have to hook up again here in the near future. And if people want more information, it's michaelfranzese.com.
Thank you, Jeff. And anytime, I'm available to you, buddy. Thank you.
And there you go, our fantastic conversation with former Mafia boss Michael Franzese. When we hook up with Michael next, we will be sure to let you know. I want to thank all of our great guests that we've had over the course of these three episodes. Declan Hill and Dale Sheehan from episode number one, Richard Pound and Gunter Younger from episode number two, and of course today, Minky Warden and Michael himself. So I also want to thank you guys for listening. If you want to go back and listen to any of these interviews or share them with friends or family, teammates, office workers, or anyone else, go to our website, crushperformance.com, and click on our podcast button. You can get all of the great interviews there. Now, on to the Olympics. The Crush War on Sugar will continue. We'll be looking at the midpoint of the NHL, the start of the Major League Baseball season, and much, much more in the upcoming weeks on Crush Performance. Again, if you have any questions, comments, smart remarks, or if you have a topic you want us to investigate or look into, let us know. We may dedicate a segment or an entire episode to your idea. So do write to us on our website, crushperformance.com. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next time on Crush Performance.
Goodbye now. Don't forget to write.
I'm Jerry Petuck, CEO of Radio Influence. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on this program, or you have some show ideas that you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you took time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means a lot. Without you, the listeners, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to this show. Don't forget to check out radioinfluence.com to see what other shows we also have to offer. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, radioinfluence.com.